Right. Good afternoon again, everyone. For those to whom I greeted earlier a few minutes ago, we now are mostly here. And so may I welcome you to the first BIPS webinar of 2024 and wish you all a happy new year. This is Dr. James White, Persian Poetry on the High Seas, Migration and the Making of an Early Modern World Literature. Dr. James White studies late medieval and early modern Iran from a transregional perspective, examining how writers and their patrons use shared sets of cultural concepts to construct what scholars now call the Persianate world. His recent book, Persian and Arabic Literary Communities in the 17th Century, explores the agency of early modern writers who migrated between Iran, India, and the Arabian Peninsula, forming a consciously globalizing literary culture. Dr. White is currently Departmental Lecturer of Persian Studies at the University of Oxford. He previously held research and teaching roles at Cambridge, also Oxford, and the Freie Universität in Berlin. And without further ado, I will let Dr. White get started. James, please carry on. The floor, literally and figuratively, is yours.
Thank you. Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for coming. I'm just going to share my screen. Okay, so my book focuses on the Western Indian Ocean during the second half of the 17th century and examines the lives and works of poets who migrated between Safavid Iran, the polities of India, among which the Mughals were the dominant force, and the Arabian Peninsula. Now, that probably seems a fairly specific topic, and you might well ask how I came to research it, why anyone would focus on migrant poets as a group of authors, and why their movements are particularly important in the late 1600s. So what I want to give you today is a sense that Persian literature of the late 17th century consists of a very large and little studied corpus of texts used across the Middle East and South Asia, not just in Iran, but in places like Mecca and Hyderabad too, and that migrant poets are really key agents in making the corpus into an intertextual dialogue linked to authors in different places through the use of shared forms and themes. You might think that these kinds of dialogues are a purely literary phenomenon, but I want to show you that there is more at stake here. When authors came together in new cities and wrote collaboratively by penning responses to one another, for example, they were also building communities of shared interests that helped to shape education and curricula, what we might call ethics, politics too, because a lot of this is happening within courtly contexts. So I see the poems that I work with as the material traces of an extremely complex social system. And I also see the expansion of this system into new places and territories spearheaded by the movement of people as a kind of globalization of ideas and ways of being. So I think this is an interesting starting point. This is a leaf from an autograph manuscript of a work called Tazkire in Asrabadi, Nasrabadi's biographical anthology, which was completed in 1676 by a writer called Muhammad Taher Nasrabadi. Nasrabadi lived in and around Esfahan, which had become the capital of Safavid Iran. He came from a wealthy landowning family that had fallen on hard times, but still retained its country estate, which he inherited. Over the course of his life, Nasrabadi became a very prominent member of the Safavid literary scene, mostly as an essayist, an editor and an arbiter of good taste. He tells us that he first began to appreciate poetry late in his teens after the death of his father, when he began to visit coffee houses where courtiers, poets and the ordinary people of Esfahan came together. It was among them that he felt a sense of belonging. In later life, when his renown as a literary figure had grown, he founded his own coffee house behind the mosque at Lonban in a suburb of Esfahan, where poets would seek him out on their visits to the Safavid capital. In so doing, he became an important node, really, in a network of poets that expanded across West, Central, and South Asia. In his middle age, Nasrabadi set himself an enormous task, which was to bring together his experiences, his notes, and his memories, and to produce a written record of the state of Persian poetry in his own era, preserving the lives of the poets for posterity. The result is his Tazkire, which contains entries on roughly 900 poets about whom he could gather information. Of these, around 10% were acquaintances that Nasrabadi tells us he met. Possible that he actually encountered many more, but he explicitly mentions having met about 90 of them. These friends then transmitted information about other poets to Nasr Abadi, corroborating biographies and offering alternative sources for lines of poetry. The result is a text that is rooted in exchanges that happened in Esfahan, but which actually expands to encompass poets who traveled through Iraq, for example, Syria, North India, the Deccan, and even as far away as Ethiopia and Europe. And to my mind, the Tazkira is a fantastic source that we can harness to understand how social connections between poets generated intertextual connections between poems. Rather than starting with divans, the collected works of individual poets, and then comparing them and combing through them to find examples of intertextuality, what I prefer to do instead is to use the Tazkira as a kind of source book and focus on exploring interactions between poets who Nasr Abadi says met one another. So just to give you a sense of who was writing poetry in the 17th century, here we can see two sets of data on the professions of migrant poets who are mentioned by Nasr Abadi. On the left, we have poets who came from elsewhere, principally from the Iranian provinces to Esfahan. And on the right, we have poets who emigrated from Iran to India. The first thing to note is quite how many people were writing poetry in the 17th century and how verse is actually bringing people from very different professions and walks of life together. So it's not just professional poets, but also religious scholars, bureaucrats and officials, artists, craftsmen, servants, merchants, musicians, doctors. There's even one innkeeper in this list. There are some quite major differences between the two groups, that is, those who came from elsewhere in Iran to Esfahan and those who left Iran for India. We can see that only a small proportion of writers on the left here who came to Esfahan traveled to seeking careers as professional poets. Most were drawn there in order to study the religious sciences at one of the state madrasas, or were involved in the life of the royal court as high-ranking bureaucrats, ministers of state, or secretaries. Trade and the crafts also represented significant reasons why poets traveled to Esfahan. In general, these statistics give some indication of the degree of centralization that Iran experienced in the 17th century. The biographies also show, I think, that many poets tried to find success in Esfahan before considering emigration to India. If you look to the right, we have a remarkably high number of the poets who are mentioned in the anthology, 178, that's about 20% of the number of poets who are studied by Nasr Abadi, who travel from Iran to India. Of these, 157 go to Mughal North India, and 21 go to the Deccan Sultanates, mostly to Shi'i Golconda. This figure exceeds the number of poets who migrated from other locations in Iran to Esfahan, indicating that India was an attractive destination for provincial Iranians. It's likely that those who lived in eastern Iranian cities, such as Mashhad, for example, may have found it just as easy to migrate to North India as to Western Iran. As the table shows, there are many more professional poets among the migrants to India. They come in top spot. So trade and politics come in second and third place, respectively, indicating the importance of the Mughal Empire to Iranian mercantile activity, the durative elite networks which connected the Safavid, Mughal, and Deccan. Merchants represent a small proportion of subjects in the anthology as a whole, but a significant minority of the migrant poets, showing the importance of trade to transnational movement. So this is a map of the Western Indian Ocean, the region over which Tazkira and Nasr Abadi ranges, and all the cities that are marked here were important centers where poets met and created dialogues with one another. We tend to have quite a rigid view of the context in which poetry was written and where it was shared. In earlier historical periods, the classic place that people think of is at an imperial court. It's true that courts, for example, the Safavid court in Esfahan, the Mughal court at Shah Jahanabad, the Qutb Shahi court at Golconda, certainly are important in the 17th century, but so are many other non-imperial settings, the urban environments of cities in particular, including public spaces like shrines where people would go for the day or for an extended period of time and meet and talk. In Iran, you have places like the Shrine of the Imam Reza at Mashhad, which becomes maybe an unexpected center of literary exchange. In Isfahan, you have coffee houses. In Kashan, you have public gardens. All of these places become integral to poetic creativity, both on a demographic level, i.e. the professions of the people who are composing poetry, and in terms of space. Poetry is bringing together a huge proportion of early modern Persian-speaking societies. We also need to think a little bit about borders, because although they were controlled, I mean borders between states, people were constantly moving in search of opportunities and employment. So it's not just the central provinces of Iran or India or elsewhere literary activity. Kabul, for example, which was the most northerly city in the Mughal Empire near the Safavid border, becomes quite a major center for Persian poetry at this time. Now, in writing the book and trying to investigate the links between the different poets that Nasrabadi mentions, I've had to use a lot of manuscripts of poetry. That's partly to do with the fact that not that much 17th century poetry has been edited and published. But one of the main points that I'd really like to reinforce is that the world that I'm talking about is one in which literary texts and manuscript culture were inseparable from one another. There was no print, obviously, and you couldn't go into a bookshop in Isfahan and get exactly the same edition of a text in Agra or in Hyderabad, because every manuscript has the potential, at the very least, to offer a unique recension. It's the uniqueness of manuscripts, but also how they carry additional information such as marginalia about when or why a poem was written. That means that if we rely on modern print editions alone, we lose a huge amount of very useful information that tells us why and for whom people were writing. And we also severely limit the number of connections that we can make between texts, because we're not examining the unpublished material, which in this case, majority of the corpus. So we really have to incorporate manuscripts into our research. So access to manuscripts is not only important today, it was also important in the 17th century. Writers could not read the same body of works wherever they were. The materials that they read were shaped by the basic practicalities of what was available to them. Contemporary, freshly composed works of literature generally circulated semi-privately in authors' notebooks or commonplaces, or in divans, collected works which were not subject to mass reproduction. This tied the process of reading to the practice of sociability, because it was only by meeting people or corresponding with them and reading the texts that they permitted you to see that you could maximize your own knowledge of contemporary corpus. Nasrabadi has a story that brings this point out. He writes of a close acquaintance named Mulla Ali Beg, who had spent a considerable amount of time in Nasrabad, had taught the young Nasrabadi calligraphy, and had retired to the village. Despite the long-lasting connection between the two men, Nasrabadi struggled to gain access to Mulla Ali Beg's collected works, as the only manuscript copy of them was owned by one of Nasrabadi's relatives, who refused to let the anthologist consult it until the Tazkira was nearing completion. So this is a family squabble that prevents Nasrabadi from reading a manuscript. But on the other hand, Nasrabadi was able to correspond with the poet Enayat Khan Oshnar, a nobleman of the Mughal court, who sent him his collected works in manuscript from India. So place not only your place as a poet in space, the city in which you live, but also social positioning becomes extremely important, because in a way it determines the kinds of dialogues this can construct. I think my favorite illustration of this point is a manuscript which is the Jang, or miscellany, of an Iranian poet and merchant called Fayyaz, who was a brother of the religious scholar Muhammad Baqir Sabzavari. Like many other poets and men of letters who carried commonplace books on their travels, Ayaz had this little blank book that he took with him on his business trip. He journeyed between Safavid Iran, Arabia, the Mughal Empire, and the Shahi Sultanate. Whenever he encountered authors during his travels, Fayyaz asked them to inscribe verse or Shi'i exegetical text in his miscellany, with the result that his manuscript contains notes in Arabic and in Persian in the hands of upwards of 37 poets and scholars of the period, many of whom, coincidentally or not, are also mentioned in Nathanael's Apology. Fayaz's miscellany gives us a very material sense of migration's role in creating literary communities. The really interesting thing about it is that it contains entries made in the port cities of Andhar Abbas in Safavid Iran, Surat on Mughal India's west coast, and Musulipatnam, the Qutb Shahi Sultanate's main port on India's southeast coast, showing how encounters happened as poets disembarked and waited for passage. So it's a very tangible demonstration of how chance encounters between people could generate textual connections. Here on screen you can see the autograph of the poet Jilhari recorded in the port of Musulipatnam in 1057, 1642. There we go. So what happened when poets arrived in new cities in search of opportunities and connections, and how did they affect they settled? This is an interesting line from a ghazal, a short lyric poem by someone called Faraj Allah Shushtari, who migrated from Iran to Hyderabad. Even though it's a lyric poem, it's written with a kind of panegyric intent. It praises the Sultan of Hyderabad, Abdallah. The poet says here, Rashke Iran shod dekan dar ahd Abdallah Shah, harche khahi ast amma baadeh Shiraz nist. The Deccan has become the envy of Iran in the age of King Abdallah. It is whatever you may wish it to be, but there is no one of Shiraz. So the piece as a whole is a deliberate attempt to make new meaning out of familiar imagery, marking dissonance in a way and the poet's dislocation from Iran after his immigration. The Deccan's physical distance from Iran, its climatic and cultural differences, force a reinterpretation of familiar imagery. The idea is that the whole concept of the wine of Shiraz and Nowruz in Iran really make no sense if you're sitting reading a poem in India, which has a completely different environment. So there's an acknowledgement here that a lot of the stock images in Persian lyric poetry, as it has been honed and practiced in Iran, lose their concrete or their tangible meaning when a poem is written and performed elsewhere. However, they still work as tropes because readers know the earlier poems, or it's assumed that readers know the earlier poems, the work of Hafez, understand the symbolism. And I think it's emblematic of how migrant poets built links, actually, between back home in Iran and these new worlds that they were constructing in South Asia. It's a clever way of ensuring that audiences in India can still consume the kinds of poetry as audiences in Iran. And in that sense, it's building communities of interest. Now, I wonder whether I can minimize it. Perhaps not. So one of Faraj Allah's contemporaries in Hyderabad was a poet called Salek Yazdi. We have a copy of Salek's Divan that is annotated with remarks on when and where he composed his poems. I put in chronological order used to reconstruct his biography. This shows how much he moved, the kinds of audiences that he tried to engage with as he migrated, and how he managed to link people in different places through his poetry. So he starts off in his hometown of Yazd as a young man, praising the mayor of the city, and then moves to Shiraz, where he writes poems for the provincial governor. He then goes up a rung and moves to the capital at Esfahan, where he writes a couple of pieces for courtiers. In about 1635, Salek then decided to emigrate to India. We can trace his path from Esfahan to Baghdad and then to Basra, where he seems to have caught a ship. This is all through dated poems. He arrived in North India and dedicated a few pieces to members of the Mughal court before heading south to Hyderabad and the Qutb Shahi Sultanate. So the quantity of his poems dedicated to the elite of the Qutb Shahi Sultanate suggests that it was in the Deccan that he found a consistent source of royal and aristocratic support. He writes pieces for Sultan Abdallah himself, some of which are eulogies, but others are occasional poems. So, for example, he chronicles the king's program of palaces and gardens. But Salek's major patrons were Mir Muhammad Sa'id Ardasai, who was the Mir Jamle, or Prime Minister of Golconda, and Mir Muhammad Said's son, Muhammad Amin. Now, the Mir Jamle famously double-crossed the Qutb Shahi Sultanate and collaborated with the Mughals, after which he was expelled from the Deccan and had to head north to Delhi. And because Salik was his protege, the Pope was too. So we find him in Delhi in about 1655, where he praises a whole series of Mughal noblemen, and eventually he dies there. So his life is really dedicated to travel and to searching for new opportunities. But that's not at all exceptional for the period. Many of the poets whom Nasr Abadi mentions experience that, you know, a similar degree of mobility. But the point is that it is exactly poets like Salek, those who move between different places, who are feeding audiences as far apart as Baghdad and Hyderabad with the same kinds of expectations about how leadership, just rule, questions of morality, for example, should be represented in poetry. They're linking these different places together. And we don't really think about it that much, but this kind of globalization of a set of practices is I think, quite remarkable. On the other hand, though, we often see shared identities which are part of a globalizing culture of ethics coming into conflict with the boundaries instituted by early modern political dispensations. We see this particularly clearly in a text entitled Tarikhe Keshikhane Humayun, The History of the Royal Guardhouse, which was completed in Esfahan in 1698 by the poet Nur ad-Din Muhammad Sharif Kashani, who died in about 1712, known by his Tahalos Najib. Najib himself features in Nasr Abadi's Tazkira as a young man, the son of a draper from Kashan, who had arrived in Esfahan several years before the compilation of the anthology. His history is a remarkable account of Najib's interactions with the Mughal prince Jalal ad-Din Akbar, who died in 1707, the third son of the emperor Aurangzeb. Akbar shouldn't be confused with his forebear, the third Mughal emperor, the great, who died in 1705. For a time, Prince Akbar acted as governor of Kashmir, and it was there that he first encountered Najib, who had emigrated to India and entered Akbar's service as a court poet in around 1676. In 1679, Akbar attempted to stage a coup against Aurangzeb, but the plot failed, and Akbar was forced to flee to the border town of Kandahar, which the Safavids had taken from the Mughals in 1648. Now, Akbar's matrilineal kinship with the Safavids made Iran the obvious destination asylum, but it was only in 1688, after about 9 years on the periphery of the empire, that the Safavid Shah Suleiman allowed him to come to Esfahan. There, three courtiers who had prior association with Akbar, one of whom was Najib, were appointed to attend the prince in watches on alternate days of the week. Ostensibly, this was to keep him company, but also, obviously, it was to collect information on him. Najib, who must have spent a total of about 800 watches with Akbar over the course of the prince's 8 years in the Safavid capital, recorded the discussions that they had in his history, which was written for the Grand Vizier and former court historiographer, Muhammad Tahir Vahid. The narratives of the watches follow the daily life of Akbar and his entourage in Isfahan, as they moved through spaces ranging from Akbar's lodgings to the gardens of Iranians who had returned from India. Now, Tarikhe Keshikhane Humayun is full of moments that speak to how a trans-regional Persian culture was both maintained and constantly undermined, as Akbar and his interlocutor muse on contrasted streams of power, consider sectarian differences, and use humor to both connect with and distinguish themselves from one another. So in one episode, Akbar goes with his entourage to the house of Mirza Ahmad, a Safavid courtier from an eminent Mughal family, and the party relaxes by fishing in a stream running through Mirza Ahmad's garden. The exiled pretender to the Mughal throne catches several fish, which he lays out on the edge of the stream. He then asks his companions what the fish are saying as their mouths convulse, promising the haul to the winner of the contest. So the different courtiers each, they go around the group, and each courtier is to have at interpreting what the fish are saying. One follower imagines that they are greeting Akbar, the emperor, Another pretends that they are predicting how they will sate the party's hunger. Akbar himself jokes that they are asking why he has forsaken sea fishing to dredge a narrow channel, which is a sort of veiled comment on his diminished circumstance and come from being Prince of India to living in exile. Najib, picking up on this, retorts, no, they're saying something else, that sea fishing has its season, but that it requires the aid of Noah's Ark, Safina Yanu. Noah's Ark is conventionally understood as a reference to the ship of theism, and so his implication is that if Akbar wants to launch an assault on the Mughal Empire, he should first convert to the Safavid state religion. Akbar is noticeably embarrassed by this comment, and other courtiers tell Najib to be sincere. He tries again and says that they are asking for water. One of the courtiers complains that his own guess was far more on point and astute, and Najib delivers his punchline, which is obviously the intention of the whole sequence. He says, just so, a leech knows the tongue of a fish better than anyone, i.e. he's calling the unnamed courtier a leech. Akbar collapses with laughter and rewards Najib's fish. So even though a fishing trip is ostensibly something innocuous and bucolic, the interactions between Akbar, his entourage, and Najib are based on this rather complicated mixture of mutual distrust on the one hand and a shared way of being on the other. Akbar's dreams of following in his ancestor Humayun's footsteps and returning to India with a conquering army must have seemed delirious to critical audiences in Iran. And there is a sense in which Najib's initial remarks are slightly cutting. His veiled remark on Shiism, dismissed as sarcasm or rants by the others, implies that Akbar should realize how dependent he is on Safavid support. At the same time, Najib is present at the gathering as Akbar's boon companion, so he's filling a social role, and there is an expectation formed through convention that he discharge the resident wit and make the pretender laugh. When he does this, Akbar says to him that he has done his job. He says, "Orechot kari." So, ultimately, here we have two visions for 17th. On the one hand, we have a circulation of poets with what seems to be very little regard for the boundaries of different states and the creation of a literature that is globalized in the sense that cognate images and forms of representation are being used around the Western Indian Ocean. So communities are connected with one another and a transnational is being formed. But at the same time, this literary field is not completely independent of political power. And actually, a sort of exclusivity is key to community formation in general, because shared interests always have their limits. There were huge political changes going on at the time that I'm discussing. So, for example, the Qutb Shahi Sultanate, where Salik worked, was incorporated into the Mughal Empire in 1687. So its court poetry effectively lost its primary audiences, and the community that had sustained Salik disappeared. Najib was writing for Akbar, a man who fantasized about becoming an emperor, so his poems only made sense, imagined to a very limited in their initial recensions. So I think we have to study both broad intertextual connections between these kinds of poems and the rest of the corpus, and reconstruct very particular local debates that authors were trying to engage in when they composed, because ultimately that's the only way that we're going to understand the corpus of 17th century Persian literature and the remarkable ways in which societies across the Persian world were connected to one another. And that is really what I've tried to do in the book. Thank you very much.
Right, James, thank you very, very much for this. Let me take the first question there. And the first question refers to the slide on society and motion. And there the questioner says, in the table regarding the migration of Persian poets to India, there was a reference to professional poets in inverted commas. Could you please explain what professional poets meant in the context of the late 17th century?
Yes, professional poets means people who make a living through composing poetry, through prose poetry, but there are also many other ways you can write for friends, for example, or you can write for subscribers, and you can earn through living. You can earn a living through writing. Professional poets stand in contrast to people like members of the clergy, for example, musicians or bureaucrats who are not earning an income necessarily through writing poetry. It's the monetization of the poetic craft.
Right. Could I follow up on that just for a second? So what you're saying is that these professional poets would be distinct from poets whose sole patron was the court? In other words, they had different sources of income from different, as it were, audiences?
Well, it's complicated because there are instances, when people travel, generally, no matter what their profession was, my sense is that they often tried, because a trip, for example, from Iran to India was a huge investment. So people generally tried to take advantage of that. And if they had, if they could find goods to trade, no matter what their job was, then they would take something with them. And so you find examples of that, the people who are going to work to import producing poetry, who decide to sell precious goods on the way, for example. But you also find the reverse. I mean, there's a famous poet called Shahpur Tehrani, I think, of the period, who travels, known as a professional poet, but he travels to India, and the biographers are very clear that a lot of what he was doing was mercantile. So he was trying to make a living through trade as well as.
Is this solely monetary, or are there examples of non-monetary compensation? Room and board is, I guess, what I'm thinking of, that sort of thing.
Yes, I mean, there are, well, in the anthologies that I've studied, there are examples of people being given items of clothing, for example, but they're not, those kinds of transactions don't actually occur that frequently. Mostly it's monetary compensation.
Okay, terrific. Okay, next question. Thank you for your lecture. Did the poets from Deccan travel to Iran, and when they did they also face rivalry from Iranian poets in Safavid courts, just as Iranian poets did in the courts of the Deccan sultans from Deccanate poets?
So there are a limited number of examples of poets traveling from South Asia to Iran. The ones that I've been able to find are not from the Deccan, they're from Kashmir. But Nasr Abadi, in his anthology, mentioned several poets, one of whom was called Darvish Yusuf Kashmiri, for example, who emigrates to from Kashmir to Isfahan. He settles there, he gets married, and he becomes a great host of gathering. So he's kind of fully integrated into the Safavid literature, and there's no implication at all that he was looked down on because he was a foreigner or anything like that.
Okay, thank you very much. Right, next question. Thank you for your inspiring lecture. I was wondering, what is the cultural or political motivation of the Mughal Empire to attract and patronize migrated Iranian poets in the 17th century?
I think I don't necessarily think that there was a sort of board of Mughal elites who were sitting around planning things, saying we need to attract poets from Iran. I think everything is significantly more organic than that. I mean, when you think about the composition of Mughal elites in the first place, so many families come from Iran because intra-Asian migration is life in this period. So I think it would have been perfectly natural for people, poets in Iran, to say, yes, I'm going to go and try my luck in India, because many would have had family connections already. Many would have been involved in businesses that were trading there. It was a natural extension of wealth.
Okay, thank you very much. Next question. Thank you for sharing your insights. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about social political conditions in India during this era, and why poets chose India in particular.
Well, I mean, it really depends. I mean, South Asia is a vast place, and social conditions varied very, very widely. So it depends what you're talking about. But I mean, factors that people tend to bring up when thinking about why poets were troubled in the first place, you know, you have issues of kind of an abundance of resources, there are questions of taxation, there's simply the fact that there are so many different courts, provincial rulers, governors, all of these meant, you know, a multiplicity of centers that people could, that poets could travel by their life, which made India a place. And I talked a little bit about the centralization of the 17th. And it's not the case, as I said before, that Isfahan was the be all and the end all. You could be a poet who went from Lahijan to Mashhad, and there are examples of poets who did that. But many people wound up in Isfahan one way or another before they decided to emigrate.
Okay, thank you very much. Have you uncovered evidence of travelers or poets moving from Iranian or Central Asian sphere to India who carry with them written manuscripts and then having illustrations added in the subcontinent? Might they have transported these objects as a means of currency or funding sources?
Well, there are examples of painters who are also poets, according to Nasr Abadi. I mean, not professional poets, but they are painters who happen to write the tongs, who travel from Iran to India, and I would assume that they took with them the materials of their trade. So I think it's highly likely included manuscripts. I can't speak about the circulation of style painting, for example, and how Iran at this time connects with painting in Mughal India.
Okay, thank you. A question here, could you comment on the presence of scholars, bureaucrats, etc. from Arabic and Turkish background in India, mostly from the Ottoman Empire, and any sort of rivalry with the Iranians present in the subcontinent that there might have been?
Yeah, so half the book actually is devoted to Arabic poetry, and I have a chapter on a figure called Ibn Ma'sum al-Madani, who was of Iranian descent. He was descended from a Safavid princess. His father grew up in Mecca and then emigrated to Hyderabad to become the prime minister of Golconda. And so there is a large presence of Arabic speaking poets, writers, authors, state officials in South Asia in the late 17th century, but their identities are often very complex. So Ibn Maktoum's father, for example, Muhammadin Ahmed, would have, even though he spoke Arabic with his son and with his close entourage, would have probably fit easily, being of Iranian, and into the politics of the court of Hyderabad. And it's pretty clear that the family also spoke Persian. So we have to think about multilingualism and differing identities, I guess, which might not align.
James May, I thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.
For the discussion, an absolutely excellent discussion. Lots of wonderful questions. There were a few I wasn't able to get to, for which I apologize to questioners. Again, a happy new year, happy 2024, and a good evening or a good morning or a good afternoon, depending upon where you are. Thank you very much, everyone. Bye-bye now.